neo-masculinity is really about three things, Mono. It's about awakening. Mm-hmm. It's about revolt. Revolt against a poisonous status quo, against a superstructure that's very toxic, anti-male, anti-masculine. And it's about resurrection.
All right, guys, welcome to the show. Mano Elia here. You are watching The Study of Stuff. I'm just walking through the streets of Mexico. But that's not what this episode is about. Before we get to that, I just wanted to give you guys a couple of updates. We got a lot of things coming up. A lot of interesting news, big news too. So stay tuned. Make sure you follow us wherever you follow things and that. We're everywhere. And if you want to help support the show, we're putting up our Patreon account up. So you know what, man? Make sure you do that stuff because it helps us. You know how it goes. Patreon.com/ManoElia. Go to that if you want to support us. All right. Today's episode, I had the wonderful pleasure of interviewing Cameron McGregor, and we had a long conversation about neo-masculinity. Now, before you all get all crazy and like, oh my God, red pill, manosphere stuff, that's the whole thing. That's the whole reason I wanted Cameron on the show. He has a totally different way of viewing the entire subject of neo-masculinity, as he puts it. But in a world full of red pill content and like Andrew Tate's and stuff, Cameron kind of has a completely different perspective of how he views it all. He's very nuanced in his approach. His videos on his channel are incredible, so please check him out. All the links will be in the description. The most important part about his process, it's not about like hating this person or hating that, or it's not sloganeering. I find a lot of that stuff is very sloganeery, and not to say that I don't like some of it and find value in it, but there's always like it stops short of solutions. It's not as deep. They don't go as deep as Cameron does. So hope you like this episode. Check it out, follow us, follow him, and stay tuned for a lot more. Anyways, my interview with Cameron, enjoy. Welcome to The Study of Stuff, and today I have a fantastic guest. I have Cameron McGregor joining me today, and we're going to be discussing, for the most part, neo-masculinity, a very important subject, I believe, in today's environment. I think it's one that's not discussed, and it's one that's discussed, but not in the particular way that Cameron kind of puts things. I think it's a big reason why I have you on, Cameron, is because in this whole manosphere, red pill, whatever you want to call it, world, there's a lot of sloganeering. There's a lot of very fantastical characters, a lot of dynamics going back and forth, kind of causing a lot of controversy, bringing up a lot of important subjects, but also it's kind of deflected by the cartoonishness of it. And I find your work with your blog, Men in the City, and how you approach the subject to be very interesting, very important. You're very nuanced in the way you approach it. You offer up a lot of data, a lot of research, a lot of your own ideas, a lot of solutions, and that's a key component to why I want you on and why I want to have this discussion with you. Being also that a lot of my audience, they're younger males. I'm getting a lot of females kind of reaching out recently too, and a lot of them are asking about this subject. And I have a lot of disturbing questions asked sometimes. The crisis is pretty intense. I'm kind of on the ground level of it, but I kind of hear a lot of the stories, and they're kind of shocking. So I'm really happy to have you on, Cameron. Welcome to the show. And if you could just kind of start off with a little bit of an introduction on yourself and how you got into this.
Sure. Well, thanks for the introduction. And obviously, masculinity at this stage is in a very precarious state. You know, I think many men are confronting existential crisis. And that means that they're facing life or death situations. In some cases, it's financial. In some cases, it's divorce. You know, the problems run the gamut. But it is a time of tremendous despair and difficulty. But within that process, there is a broader awakening. There is a transformation happening. And we'll get into that. And that is the essence, I would say, of neo-masculinity. Neo-masculinity is really about three things, Mono. It's about awakening. Mm-hmm. It's about revolt. Revolt against a poisonous status quo, against a superstructure that's very toxic and anti-male, anti-masculine. And it's about resurrection. And I think all three of these threads are pulling together at the same time. And that's what makes this space very difficult and at times very toxic. Mm-hmm. But it's necessary. It's forcing men to reevaluate society and themselves. So that's what my work focuses on. For me, I began my career in the military, which did not go all that well. I have a video on my channel. In fact, it's the first video that I put out that addresses that theme. But I, like many men of our generation, fell into a very difficult time. I was unemployed. I was living in extreme scarcity and isolation, and I didn't have a whole lot of hope. And so I had to fight my way through that process. And it was very much a fight, an emotional, spiritual, physical, physiological fight. And I survived. I was able to climb out and reconstitute an identity. And in that process, was a harrowing journey. And I think men today are experiencing that journey in various ways. And that's why I created this channel, so that I could help them structure what they were experiencing, not to provide a five-step process to riches and women and all the rest of it, but so that they could identify with some of the turmoil that I went through and understand that they're part of something bigger. That's really what's happening in the world right now, is that men are coming together into a broader movement. I call it the neo-masculine movement. Mm-hmm. And it's preparation, Manu. It's preparation for some very hard times that are imminent, in my view. You might say an existential crisis that's going to emerge in the Western world, but it's one that I believe is necessary and one I think we're going to overcome together. And I think the other side of that is going to be a much better world. So for me, I went through this process. I came out on the other end, and so now I suppose I'm trying to help shepherd men through the same process and build us into something bigger.
Well put, and it does, it definitely shows in a lot of the videos you put out, and I highly suggest them to everyone. And kind of getting into that a little bit, I think history and putting things into context is important, because a lot of people kind of see this whole thing as they just kind of sprouted out of nowhere, hit them all back up the backside of their head, and all of a sudden, like, what is all this stuff going on? But if we kind of like trace it back through history, we see that this is an ongoing ebb and flow of this constantly kind of coming into the zeitgeist. And you did a great job with a great video called Breaking the Sex Cycle. And in it, I mean, I'm going to take it a little bit further or from it in a different direction. Kind of like the beginning of the end of every civilization, you kind of find this feminization, like whether it's Egypt or Greece. And then Rome is a particular interesting example where you have the split between the Eastern Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire. On the West, they kind of continued with this feminization, paganism, and sexual debauchery. And on the East, you have everyone kind of maintaining tradition, and they have a 1,000-year run as the Byzantine Empire. You kind of really see that right there. Then you kind of fast forward to like the French Revolution and communism and all of this. If you could speak about how all of that kind of fits together and how you see like the beginning of this entire situation that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, absolutely. So I frame it, and you're exactly right to reference history. You know, Americans, to our credit, tend to be very forward-looking. We tend to be solutions-oriented. We tend to focus on self-improvement. And those are all important cultural advantages. However, when it comes to the past, we tend to have amnesia. Yes. We don't even understand our own country in many respects. And that is a tremendous disadvantage when trying to process what's happening in the world. And just as an aside, it's very interesting you mention the difference between the Eastern and the Western Roman Empires, because in a video I made recently, I talked about the rise of Asabiya, a kind of neo-masculinity in the East. And a lot of people don't really understand what's happening in countries like China and Russia and India. But essentially, you're seeing a civilizational resurgence, and it's embodying itself in strong men that are emerging in opposition to what's happening in the West, which is the feminization and the globalism, you know, this emasculation that's packaged in the form of modernity and progress, but it's actually a reversion, or it's a regression. It's not progress at all. I split the world right now, or the timeline that we're in two terms. One is the age of scarcity, and the other is the age of prosperity. The age of prosperity is what we're exiting. So we've been in a period, I would say, at least since the 1960s, although you could go back earlier, in which we've had a steadily rising standard of living. We've had abundance. We've had cheap energy. We've had the accumulation of wealth. and that wealth has been splurged upon in various forms. And you're seeing the residue of that in our culture. Everything today is about self-aggrandizement. It's about self-enrichment. It's about making as much money as you can and then ostentatiously displaying that wealth. The discipline associated with creating the age of prosperity is lost in that process. Yes. People forget about how that prosperity was originally built because it was built in the age of scarcity. And I have gendered these ages. One, the age of scarcity is a masculine era. That's when the hard work is done. That's when the shadow work that's required to build the rail lines, to develop the internal combustion engine, to lay the brick and mortar, you know, the inventiveness, the dynamism is applied to actually erect these castles in the sky. And the age of feminine is a period of maintenance. Yep. It manages that process after it's already been constructed. And over time, as time progresses, you forget how these things were built. You lose touch with reality. And that is more feminine energy, right? There's mm-hmm. a sense that abundance can be spoken into existence without hard work, mm-hmm. without conflict, without violence. You know, all of these things are associated with masculinity. And you reach a point of total delusion. You know, it's a lot of men in the manosphere talk about a reality distortion field that female energy emanates. You know, you see a beautiful woman and you almost forget yourself. You're lost in her beauty, yeah. right? It creates this distortion of reality. And you then begin to pedestalize the female. Well, that's the effect of the age of the feminine. You see it in our institutions. You see it in the lack of planning, the lack of discipline, and the total disregard for the masculine psyche itself, which is combative, which embraces conflict, because the combativeness and the conflict strips down all of the distortion, all of the delusion into the brick and mortar of reality. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that process spirals out of control. Genders are confused. You know, basic truths that built society are abandoned. And that can perpetuate itself for a while until society hits an existential crisis. Usually in the form of a financial, economic, a climactic catastrophe, or war, and in some cases, Mano, all three. It may be the case that we experience all three. Either way, that age of prosperity spirals out of control, implodes, and then you get the age of scarcity all over again. And that's what I have termed winter is coming. It is. It's arrived. And I think men are going through a tremendous period of difficulty in preparation for that. They don't really know it. It's hard to believe that. It's hard to see that when you're in the trenches. But men, their awareness is growing. And that's the key. An awareness, a higher consciousness that masculinity is coming back, mm-hmm. that a new movement of restoration is upon us. And that's what we're going through today.
Define how you view new masculinity as how it differs with others, where it's a little bit more, like I mentioned earlier, it's a little bit more cartoonish, a lot of sloganeering, and less solution-based. How does that fit in for this new era that you're describing there?
There is a phrase that you hear sometimes among folks, in many cases, people that put out good content that I think helps men through divorce, helps men deal with financial scarcity, you know, is not necessarily harmful, but a lot of these people will argue that men today are disadvantaged in various ways and that we need to enjoy the decline. Yeah. So we can't really combat, or we can't really deal with this broader malaise, this broader decline. So what we can do is try to maximize our skills within that structure to enjoy the decline.
Yep.
There is some utility in that. And I think we all practice that to some degree. But neo-masculinity is not about enjoying the decline. Mm-hmm. It's about preparing for an existential moment mm-hmm. in which masculinity, which is really at its core, its leadership, mm-hmm. is going to be demanded again. And, you know, I liken it to the idea of change. How do you change an institution? A lot of people will ask these questions. How do you change a country or whatever? You don't change it by assimilating into it. You don't change it yep. by accepting yep. the terms that put you at a disadvantage. you accept it, or rather you engage in that fight by rejecting it. And that's what you're seeing to some degree in the form of cartoonish characters like Andrew Tate. Mm-hmm. You know, Tate is a categorical rejection to some degree of the world as constituted, and that's necessary. The cartoonish version of that, of course, is the making ridiculous money and, you know, you might say ostentatiously displaying your wealth and your power in opposition. You might think of Tate as an adolescent, right?
Yeah.
A kind of rebellious spirit. Yeah. And that's needed, right? Yeah. Men need to embrace that rebelliousness. But what I'm talking about is a broader movement. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of revolt that's embedding itself in this higher consciousness, and men just saying, look, here's the line. These are the things that I'm not going to embrace anymore. I'm not going to accept wokeism. I'm not going to accept feminism anymore. Yep. I'm not going to accept, you know, digging ditches for corporations, knowing all the while that my livelihood is being destroyed. So that's the delineation I would make. Enjoy the decline versus revolt. Neo-masculinity is the latter, and it's building. It's beginning to proliferate, I think, in the psyches of young men, not just in the West, but around the world.
I see it too here on the ground level. Like a lot of the questions I'm getting have changed considerably in the last 3-4 months in particular. I'm noticing that it went from a lot of aggression, a lot of like flashiness, like you just described with Andrew Tate, to a lot more like, okay, I kind of got that out of my system. What do I do with this? Kind of like when they get through the Jordan Peterson phase, they're like, okay, so I clean my room. Now what do I do?
That's right.
And I find that your content kind of gives that answer. It gives a specific, like, let's build by doing these things. Part of it, which is to kind of revolt and kind of let people know, as you said, drawing the line in the sand. Keeping with that, I also find that we deal with a lot of like social engineering subjects on my podcast. And one of the things that I find interesting is there's always like this dichotomy that they always want you to get stuck in this dialectic. They want you to pick like Coke or Pepsi, red and blue is constantly like flashed in your face. And you always have like this Trump Biden thing. And then there's always like neither, like, you know, there's like a middle ground. There's more realistic, practical ways of around this. And I find that the Andrew Tate characters of the world, as you said, I do agree that they're necessary to a certain point. It kind of helps the social engineers kind of deflect people into bad behavior, or to kind of go into the other side of just like ruminating over ideas and thoughts without any action. So for those young men out there that reach out to me, could you give some good ideas or good tactics or techniques to kind of find grounding and start moving towards solutions?
Sure. So I think a very critical piece of all of this is to let go of the wealth obsession, the wealth porn. You know, I made a video about this that did better than I expected. And I think it will gain increasing momentum as the years move ahead. But, you know, wealth as defined in fiat, you know, the number of units that you hold in a bank account and so forth, has nothing to do with your value. It doesn't. Yeah. And if you embrace that idea, there's real power in that, because then you can let go of the notion that you have to execute a 10-step program. You have to get onto this escalator that ascends you into this high tower of wealth. You don't. You do not need to do that. Instead, what you need to focus on is your own identity. Mm-hmm. The beginning of every hero's journey is an existential crisis. Yep. It is a question of identity. And identity is something you deal with internally. Mm-hmm. Has nothing to do, really, with the outside world. It's how you interpret the outside world. And you have to look at yourself first. You know, I made a video over the summer about finding your cave as a man.
Yeah, it's a good one.
If you look at a lot of these superhero films, and they're superficially tapping into this, which is why they're so popular. But the inception of that process begins with a fortress of solitude. And that forces you to confront your failings, your weaknesses, your limitations. And upon those limitations and weaknesses and failures and insecurities and so forth, that's leading you towards the direction that you need to go. You know, if you come from a family that's broken, that suggests that you need to build a new one, right? Yeah. If you come from tremendous wealth, which is a tremendous advantage in many respects, it suggests that you need a path that diverges from that so that you can learn how to live separate and distinct from the money that was given to you, right? Because you didn't necessarily earn it yourself. Conversely, if you come from nothing, then you can make something of yourself, right? So in that process, that informs how you should begin your journey. And that has nothing to do fundamentally with making six figures or making $1 million or mm-hmm. owning a Brioni suit, so forth and so on. It's the identity that is the key, right? And that identity starts in internally. It starts in the conflict in your mind. So I think that's the first step. The second step is to say, okay, what do I fundamentally believe in? And if you don't believe in something, you should not do it. Yep. You know, it is almost taken as a given, as a pre-existing condition, that in the modern world, you have to sacrifice what you believe in right away. I hear it all the time. People say this to me all the time. If you want your YouTube channel to grow, Cameron, this is what people will say to me. You need to have attractive women on your channel. You need to have a panel of people, some are men, some are women, and you need to red pill these women on screen. You know, you need to become fresh and fit. No, you need to be who you are. You need to pursue the things that you believe in that have nothing to do with what anybody else wants you to think or believe. And if you do that, the internal combustion engine of your psyche will propel you forward. That's where the ammunition really exists, right? To propel you to that next level. That has nothing to do with money. It has nothing to do with conforming to social proof, right? To making other people happy. There's so much power in separating from that. And that's to some degree why the social conditioning, as you say, militates against that, right? It's designed to deter you from doing that. No, you must focus on money. You must focus on joining the corporation. You can't survive if you don't. The opposite is the case. And I'll finish on this point. You know, there's a lot of men that I've met in my life that are very wealthy. And so on paper, they're very successful. And a lot of these guys are miserable. And they very commonly have a midlife crisis. And, you know, one wonders, why do you have a midlife crisis? You were successful at the company. You have the corner office. You have the trophy wife. You have the nice car. What's wrong with you? This is what's wrong. They sacrificed their libidinous character. They never face that existential moment. They never embrace their own identity. So instead, they followed the beaten track, if you will. They did what society told them to do, and they made money, and they achieved social status as a result, and it didn't work. They're miserable. Absolutely. They didn't do what they really believed in. They didn't focus on their own identity. That's what men need to do. And you don't need millions of dollars and so forth. You don't need lots of followers to tell you what you really believe in. You can do that on your own. And if you do that, there's power in there that's like gravity. It will pull what you need towards you, resources, females, and likewise.
I really love how you put that. That was awesome. And I hope everyone out there really takes that in, because that nails it. That's really great. And it kind of leads me right into the next subject, which kind of fits in very nicely with your last comment there. The entire dating market and what we see before us, and how much it's changed from the game, the book, The Game, to today. And especially the last 3 years, it's incredible. I'm looking at some bizarre statistics that I keep hearing online, and I started looking them up, and I was disbelief to how accurate they were. Like, one in three males under the age of 30 is either a virgin or hasn't had sex in the last year. Declining birth rates, marital rates dropping substantially. And then you point out the dropout of the male, not only from the dating game, but the entire, like, society in general.
Yes.
And I think you're one of the very few that touches upon that. And I'm seeing it in my life, like with the younger guys in my life, the people that reach out to me, family members, and it's quite disturbing. So, like, riff on that in any which angle you want to take that, and why is that the case, the dating scene and the outcome?
Yeah, so this is a fairly complicated issue, in part because, you know, the genders are not designed to be antagonistic. And this is such a frustration for men today, because there is so much toxicity directed at them. And it is systemic. And we know that because women echo power And I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. And men echo the struggle for power. In other words, women are naturally designed to accommodate. They are high in openness, right? They are agreeable, mm-hmm. and they want consensus. They want social harmony. And so when society conditions people to believe certain things, it's the female that ultimately is going to reflect that conditioning more than anybody else. Because her strategy, whether it's from an evolutionary standpoint or it's a spiritual perspective, whatever, in all of these facets, that's the feminine energy, right? And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. You know, it's not a bug, as they say. It's a feature. It's simply a part of the female psyche. And it's necessary because women are the foundation of the family. Yeah. And they are necessary to achieve that continuity or to demonstrate that continuity so that the next generation can emerge in a stable environment. However, if the social conditioning is poisonous, they reflect that. And so women in the West today are extremely hostile to men. And it's not just average men. You know, I think that's a myth as well. There are a lot of women that are very hostile to Andrew Tate, as an example. And I think we can all agree, whatever else you may think of the man, he is not average. There are athletes that have fallen victim to, you might say, poisonous feminine energy, you know, that have been taken advantage of. Maybe they were Me Too'd. You know, these are various ripple effects of this toxicity in which the genders have been turned against one another, and specifically females. And so men, by virtue of being the recipient of this negativity, they're turning away. They're divesting from the system. And it's not just the dating marketplace. There seems to be a fixation on that, but it's not exclusive or peculiar to the dating marketplace or the sexual marketplace. They're divesting from society at all because women represent society.
Yes.
It's not just that they represent sexual choice. They do, but they represent how the power structure feels about men. And so understandably, men are saying, well, look, you know, what the hell is the point of this? Why am I participating in a game that disadvantages me on the one hand, but on the other hand, despises me?
Yeah.
And so it's very understandable why they're doing what they're doing. Okay, well, I think a lot of that is understood. If not explicitly, it's understood intuitively. What are we as men supposed to do about that? Mm-hmm. Well, to some degree, it's already happening. Men are developing parallel communities. This is the rationale for the red pill community, or the manosphere, if you will. Mm-hmm. Men are beginning to reorganize. They're beginning to diverge into parallel communities where they can voice these concerns. And ultimately, that red pilling process reaches critical mass to the point where it challenges that order, that social order. We're at the beginning stages of that. That's neo-masculinity, okay? Yep. So they're divesting from a corrupt social order, and they're reinvesting in a new parallel structure. What about dating in the meantime? like money, chasing women, chasing females is a fool's errand. Anybody that really understands female selection or the sexual marketplace, which is the domain of the female, knows that you can exert tremendous energy if you want to, trying to attract women, but ultimately it's their choice. It's at their discretion. Mm-hmm. And so what we have to accept at the moment is that a lot of these women are poisoned. They're perverted by this toxic and corrupt social order. And there's not much we can do about that. There simply isn't. But wasting a lot of time to remake yourself into an accommodating mate, if you will, this is what a lot of men do. They accommodate that kind of behavior, whether in a marriage or relationship. It's self-destructive. And ultimately, it destroys the marriage, the relationship is destroyed, or the male is destroyed. You know, these things can go tragically wrong because men tend to take responsibility. We tend to blame ourselves when things go wrong. I think a better approach is to simply say, look, if this woman or these women don't like me, if they're not going to conform, or rather, if they're not going to accept my worldview, the values that I believe in, then the hell with them. then I'm going to have to just press ahead with the things that I do believe in, knowing full well that eventually you will attract the right female, or at least you will participate in an effort, in a broader movement that is going to right the ship. And again, that gets us back to neo-masculinity. So I think all of those things are more or less happening. It's just that men can't reason through that process. They haven't articulated it in the manner that I have. But I think they're beginning to figure out that the sexual marketplace is toxic. And so divesting from it to some degree, at least in the short term, is the right way to play the game. And I think getting off the social media apps, you know, rejecting what would you call it, online dating, I think that's crucial in that process. You should not participate in any of those online forums and just try to meet women in your daily life who can see your self-worth much better and then will gravitate towards you accordingly. And that's not, it's not a scientific process. It's not a rationalistic program, right? That's something I think a lot of men get very upset by is they say, well, if I do these five steps, then the output will equal this, that, or the other. That's just not the way the female mind works. It ebbs and it flows. It's a wave of energy. It's a continuum. So it is not something or subject to your robotic approach. All you can do is self-actualize. And in the process, you'll attract the right female over time. It's not easy, but it will come.
Yeah, I like that, that segue into like, getting on off the whole online dating thing and kind of rethinking how we used to always do it. I mean, I'm 45 and I still recall getting the shakes, just trying to go up to a girl to ask her to dance, never mind anything more than that, or approaching a girl at a coffee shop or whatever, this and that. But it kind of it builds character. You get used to rejection or just getting over that entire whole thing, and that kind of seems to be taken away from young men. And also because of the ease of dating with an app, that is not the ease of dating, the ease of picking and choosing just based on statistics, you can't even show your personality. Like oftentimes I remember when I was younger, the guy with the genuine good guy personality, but I mean the real good guy, not the, like the, you know, placating to women's needs, but like an actual good person, like he would always outdo everybody else in a lot of ways. And I think that's kind of lost in our culture. And I see it with women too. I see a lot of them complaining about the outcome of the dating industry. And I'm getting those questions a lot. Like, oh, I did all these things, and you know what? It's starting to affect my life. No one wants to marry me. Why don't they want to marry me? Like they're asking me these questions, and I'm like, well, yes. What do you bring to the table?
Yes.
Like you were asking of men, what do you bring to the table for so long? Now they're gone because you're not participating. So what do you bring to the table?
Yep. Yeah, I think, you know, there's something very important what you said regarding the courtship process. Mm-hmm. Courtship is a process. Yes. It requires a certain discipline. You know, women, in their essence, are tests for men. And that's, in some sense, again, that's explaining what this neo-masculine puzzle that we're all trying to solve is all about. Because if women are tests for men, and women are poisoned because of the poisonous social structure that they mimic, mm-hmm. what does that say about where we stand today? It says that ultimately the way these women behave, the toxicity with which they deal with men, needs to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. We need to hold them accountable for that kind of behavior as well.
Yes.
And that means we need to demand social norms. You know, one of the things that men really don't understand in our day and age, because of what you just said, Mano, because they don't interact with women much organically, is that the female mind is extremely fluid. Mm. It's very impressionable. So the environment, a man has tremendous power to influence a woman. And a lot of that power is indirect. It's intuitive,
yep.
right? And it depending on how forceful you are as a man, you can completely change the way a woman thinks about things. And so part of what's lacking today, and part of the reason why a lot of these women behave as tyrants, I mean, a lot of this feminine energy is toxic, mm-hmm. and it's become mm-hmm. tyrannical
yep.
because there are no social sanctions against it.
Yep.
Because there's no shame, there's yep. no expectation, you know, and in my own life, I am very forceful with a lot of the women that I deal with. And I'll say, look, these are the things I'm not going to tolerate. Mm-hmm. I just will not tolerate it. And if you don't like it, then there's the door.
Yep.
And a lot of times that has the reverse effect yep. that you might think.
Yep.
It actually builds attraction because it cultivates a degree of respect in the female. And you don't, execute that strategy in a mean-spirited way.
Exactly.
What you need to do is make clear boundaries that are based on your worldview. It's not just about, you know, cheating or infidelity or spending your money, you know, taking advantage of you, all these things. It's like, it's an expression of your inner masculine core. You know, these are the things that I believe in. And beliefs are intolerant, right?
Yep.
They are rooted in the idea that I have certain standards
yep.
that I don't lower for anybody. And women respond to that. They will conform to that. But if society doesn't demand any standards of them, if there are no social sanctions against their behavior, and really that's the permutation in society today. It's not that the laws have changed, because in many respects they haven't. It's that those social sanctions, those taboos mm-hmm. against certain female behavior, they're completely gone. So when you deal with them, you have to some degree, counter that lack of social sanction by imposing them yourself. And it does demand tremendous strength of character to do that. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. But if you do it, the results will come. And a lot of women will leave and they'll just say, hey, to hell with you. I don't want to deal with it. Fine. You have saved yourself real trouble. The opposite strategy, which is what most men, I'm sad to say, execute today, is one of accommodation. It's mm-hmm. one of passive mm-hmm. aggressiveness. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of studies that have been done on this, Mono, and actually they demonstrate that the more accommodating you are to this kind of tyrannical female behavior, the less respect they have for you.
Yes.
And the more likely the relationship is to fall apart.
That's very true. I can speak to that myself from my life. I've been accused of having conviction as if it's a bad thing, and integrity yep. as if it's a bad thing. Like, I remember I used to work at a super woke company a couple of years ago, and that yep. was actually brought up as a complaint on one of my reviews. But I think it's also something that men have to take responsibility for too. And I think that's sometimes overlooked in the manosphere, is like, we got here because we kind of stepped aside. We got to this point because we didn't do exactly what you just said and call that crap out when it was happening. And be like, I remember in the 80s and 90s, where it was like being pushed on television and all this stuff with like, who's the boss, and all these characters where they're feminizing strong men. And we kind of bought into it. Some of us were like, okay, this is progressive. This is what we're supposed to do. And we kind of allowed for it to happen. But I know in my life, whenever I did exactly what you just said and like took no more, I thought it was going to push people away. And you'd see that light turn on in their eye and they're like, oh, he told me where to go. You know what I mean? Like, I think we need to take responsibility as men to A, be accountable for allowing this to happen, and B, by being accountable for knowing that we allowed it to happen, that we can make a change based on a lot of the stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the words that I use often to characterize the masculine archetype or the masculine psyche, one of the characteristics that defines it is polarity.
Yeah.
And, you know, polarity today, when somebody is defined as or characterized as polarizing, you know, you hear this with Trump all the time, mm-hmm. it's perceived as a negative, mm-hmm. as an insult, mm-hmm. As a vituperative descriptor. But it's not. It's not a pejorative. It's power.
Yep.
Because polarity repels, but it also attracts. Mm-hmm. And in the process of doing both, ultimately, you're gathering onto yourself your power, right? You're pushing away people that don't share the values that you do. A, that's very good, because you're keeping harmful or potentially destructive forces at bay. And at the same time, you're attracting others that do share those values to you. Mm-hmm. So polarity is a very powerful attribute in today, because men are so emasculated by these institutions. You said it yourself. In the corporate world, you are reproached every month, every week, every hour that you're in some of these Fortune 500 companies for being polarizing.
Mm-hmm.
Because by virtue of being polarizing, you're resisting the machinery around you.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, that speaks to the fact that what's happening with men today, it's beyond the wokeism. It's beyond the feminization, the emasculation. It's also, to some degree, a facet of this corporatization.
Yes.
You know, this bureaucratization of the world that encourages everybody to just conform. You know, just fill out the form, let it go.
Yeah.
You know, just follow the new ordinance. You know, it's really, is it really that big of a deal, Mono? You know, and that encourages that, I think people call it betatization.
Mm.
And I think that's exactly what it is. Yeah. Over time, your masculine essence just sort of acquiesces. You're assimilated, and that's the end of it. And that manifests itself in your dealings with the opposite sex. It manifests itself in your work environment. You know, I would say across the board, it discourages you from being your authentic self, from your polarized self. But that's what you have to be. And what ultimately happens to a lot of men is they hit a breaking point in which they've had enough. And that's when you see that reversion to their authentic self. And it usually comes with reckless abandon. You know, it's this sort of this buildup towards an explosion. And by the way, that's what's happening collectively. Mm-hmm. That's what's occurring at a grand scale across the Western world, is that this buildup, this momentous event is coming because men are hitting the breaking point. We're saying, all right, this is the line, and across that line, we are no longer marching.
Yeah, well put. That kind of takes me into like another question that I wanted to talk to you about. You did a great job in I forgot the name of the video, but I'm definitely going to put it in the show notes, where you described alphas, betas, and then you went into a good man versus a high value man. Because you're the first person that I've heard actually talking about that. And as you were doing, I was in the gym and I started clapping. I feel like, what's going on with this guy? Just like you really hit a note with me on that. I'll let you riff on that because it was brilliant. So go through the description of the alphas, betas to the deltas. Because also that was another thing. Like I know a lot of people in these categories. So I'll give it to you.
So let me just say at the outset, because you know a lot of folks that are listening to this are probably down on themselves because they don't have millions of dollars, they don't have 10 or 20 different girlfriends, so forth and so on. Maybe they have what they perceive to be a dead end job. Maybe they're construction workers, they're plumbers, whatever. But the truth is that it's those men that society depends upon. Without them, we are nothing. Mm-hmm. And I can specifically give you a military application for this. You know, I started my career in the U.S. Navy, and people often think of militaries as highly dependent in terms of their success or failure on officers, on the people that are at the top commanding, or maybe, you know, non-commissioned officers, you know, the managers. And that's utter nonsense. The people that win your wars, the people upon which everything hinges, are these boots on the ground, the men that take action, not the men that make policies or make speeches, but the people that are actually implementing and operationalizing these policies in the real world. And Vox Dei put out a video years ago, which I always thought was very well drawn. He called it the socio-sexual hierarchy. And that hierarchy consists of alphas, betas, deltas, gammas, and omegas. The working man, in the military, we would term it the sailors or the Marines, you know, the enlisted men, they are the deltas. The construction workers, the plumbers, you know, these are the men that make society function. Without them, everything falls apart. And so the delineation between a good man is that a good man ultimately is invested in making the entire society function properly. In other words, his life is not just about his enrichment. Mm-hmm. It's about the broader society. This is the guy that works extra shifts to make a little bit more money for his family, right? He's the guy that makes sure that there are safety precautions, you know, on the construction site, so forth and so on. The alphas, the betas, this obsession with these men that are at the top of the social sexual pyramid, they're not the indispensable people at all.
Mm.
It's not to say they're bad people, but a lot of those people could care less whether or not society functions at all. They're not invested in it. Their enrichment to some degree depends upon the system wobbling out of control. They have, in other words, they profited from the decline of society. They've sold out. Yep. You know, think of these men as the CEOs, you know, the members of the board of a lot of these companies, that let a lot of the manufacturing base of the United States move overseas. Mm-hmm. And believe you me, Mana, they knew what the consequences would be. Absolutely. They knew that people's lives would be destroyed. Yep. They knew that those jobs were never going to come back. Yep. And they didn't give a damn. Yep. Because they enriched themselves. Yep. Well, you know, according to this toxic hierarchy that we identify with now in the West, they're the alphas because they made all the money. They're at the top. They've got all the women. Okay, great. But that has nothing to do with really being a good man. Maybe society values that man, but there's nothing virtuous in them at all. They're not really a part of the society within which they live. And we know that because they have no respect for it. If they did, they would not have done what they did. And they did so knowing full well that they would reap the benefits and everybody else would suffer outsized consequences. And that mentality, that ethos has infected the elites mm-hmm. across the board mm-hmm. in the West. This is, by the way, to some degree, why the black pillars are wrong, yep. right? Because they somehow think that the system is rigged in such a way that we can never prevail.
Yep.
It's not the case, because in the process of destroying some of these institutions or undermining the economy, you know, of foiling the hopes and dreams of the deltas upon which society depends, they're self-sabotaging. They're ensuring their own destruction. And that's why you're going to get a neo-masculine movement that's going to emerge to reset the entire system. That's the nature of this tension. So you're exactly right. Good men are the men that make the system go. Mm-hmm. They are invested in society. A lot of these high-value men, quote-unquote, they could give a shit about it. They don't care.
That's very true. And it's I fell into some of those traps myself over the years. And the moment that I kind of caught the wave of the most satisfaction, I can't say happiness, but satisfaction and the most respect was when I started to like really focus on just taking care of my family, putting everything else aside and going, this is the only thing that matters. And I kind of exactly. got a taste of that feeling my dad had, my grandfather had, all that stuff, you know? And yeah, I think you make a really good point with that there. We're getting closer to the tail end of the conversation. I did want to touch on some crypto stuff, but I know we don't have a lot of time. But maybe sure. it'll be like at the start of a next. We'll have a conversation sometime down the road.
Sure.
But
happy to do so.
Oh, that's great. Sorry, I kind of put you on the spot there.
No. It's okay.
But
listen, you know, just real quick, Mano. Yeah, yeah. You know, I have a company called Adactum, and Adactum yeah. does various things. One of which is investments, but. You know, I have various business partners that I work with on any given week, and I field inquiries from people periodically that are requests for interviews. Yours was one of them. And some people will say, well, you know, if somebody has fewer subscribers than you do, you should talk to them. Or if they don't have, you know, the social cachet or they're not at your level, you know, I don't believe in that at all. And that speaks to what I said a moment ago. So what if somebody has millions of followers? Mm-hmm. You know, what does that really mean? What's more valuable are these people that are invested in society. So, you know, one of the principles that I advocate recurringly, as I think you know from watching my videos, is ignore social proof. Mm-hmm. I don't care how many followers mm-hmm. people have. I don't care how much money they make. What matters to me is the substance of what they say. And I try to focus on that in a vacuum. So if you're doing good work, you know, I don't care if five people follow your channel, then I'll come on and be happy to do so.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much. And I'm definitely going to want to have you back on and talk a little bit more, go a little bit deeper on crypto, especially with the coming year. We have a lot of interesting news on the horizon and all that stuff. And what I wanted to kind of say was, okay, so first of all, I've been into crypto on and off for about 8 or 9 years now. Mm-hmm. So I kind of know a little bit, not a lot. My team, we all have different tasks, and one of them is crypto. That's not my mind's more of understanding the geopolitical spectrum of how everything fits in together. But one of the things is how you talk about Bitcoin. I heard you and Jay Dyer talking about Bitcoin, and I really like how you both spoke about it. I do have some concerns about the surveillance end of things in terms of, yep. of crypto. And I guess it's less of a basic question, but it's so here's my take on Bitcoin, because I get a lot of questions about how I feel about Bitcoin. And I, and on any subject, I'm never like all in on anything. And there's a lot of like people that are, you know, Bitcoin crazy, you know, Bitcoin maxis and all that, as they call them. And there's other people that hate Bitcoin. I'm kind of in the middle. I understand the value of Bitcoin. I understand that it's a long-term investment. It's good for in that regard. It's not digital gold, but it has a lot more real-world value than fiat, for sure. Fiat has no value. So I get all that stuff. Where I disagree with the Bitcoin maxis is that it's not anonymous, and people kind of make this claim. And we kind of don't know its initial beginnings, who has investment in it, who doesn't.
Yes.
I'm not making any claims, but I know that there's a lot of questions to be asked. How do you see Bitcoin and the crypto sphere in general kind of fitting into this new masculinity? And we'll go from there.
Yes. Yes. So a very good question. I think it is of seminal importance, not just to neo-masculinity, but to this reformation that I talk about at length in the West. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you consider the root and branch of this poisonous structure that we're dealing with, it is the money system. It is fiat that is at the center of it. It's not propaganda. Mm-hmm. It's not the educational system. It's not wokeism. All of those things ultimately depend on a financial system that sanctions them, or that scales them, protects them. You know, we know, as an example, that censorship is less so about political activism. You know, it's less so non-profiteers that are knocking at your door than it is financial censorship. If the banks don't like you, they will demonetize you. They will close your bank accounts. Now, we've heard in recent months about Nigel Farage and people like that. Mm-hmm. That's because they're famous. This has been going on for years. Yep. Anybody that the establishment didn't like ultimately was excluded from the financial system. And ironically, that has scaled to nations, right? The sanctions launched against the Russians. And now you have countries from around the world that are increasingly skeptical of Western financial institutions because they fear being sanctioned themselves, or they have been at some point in the distant or in the recent past, right, or the distant past. And so they're openly questioning whether or not they should even use this financial system. Crypto is not necessarily a panacea for all these issues. You know, as you say, ultimately, if somebody wants to track your transactions on Bitcoin, they can do that. There are some cryptocurrencies like Monero, for example, which are more anonymous than Bitcoin. But crypto in general, and Bitcoin in particular, I think have achieved escape velocity. Enough people around the world recognize what they are. And my argument on Jay Dyer's program was simply to say that cryptocurrency in general, and Bitcoin in particular, represent an alternative financial system.
Yes.
Now, for the moment, that's not how they're treated. They are speculative assets that people are investing in to enrich themselves. But ultimately, their success or failure depends upon two things. One is the viability or the survival of the legacy financial system, which I believe is demolitioning as we speak. Mm-hmm. We can talk more about that in a minute. But second, Bitcoin's success also depends upon a political movement that will institutionalize it, that will streamline it, that will mainstream it. And you're seeing evidence that political movement is there. Mm-hmm. And that's why I have said that the Bitcoiners they do fit into this neo-masculine movement, because they're trying to reform a legacy financial system. And there will be trade-offs, just as there are with gold. There are trade-offs in every financial system.
Absolutely.
Now, some Bitcoiners will maintain that it is more or less the perfect monetary system. I don't think there is such a thing.
Yeah.
But I think relative to the legacy financial system, Bitcoin can transact without a third party. Bitcoin can scale. It's liquid, unlike gold, right? There are certain discriminators that favor Bitcoin. There are also problems with it. It's the scalability of transactions is still somewhat of a problem. I think that can be dealt with from a technical standpoint, right? It is software at the end of the day, and I think those things can be dealt with. But that is a problem. The onboarding process, custodying your Bitcoin, that's a problem too, right? And there are certain bespoke you might say enterprise level services that the banking system provides today. Yeah, I'm privy to them because of my company and the business that I do, but Bitcoin simply doesn't provide those yet. Mm-hmm. But if the financial system implodes, which I believe is happening as we speak, mm-hmm. and if there is a sufficient neo-masculine movement that endorses and mainstreams Bitcoin, it is the future. And I think both of those things are going to happen. But, and this is a word of caution to everybody listening, we're not there yet. We're in this transitional period, which yes. means that fireworks are going to fly. And so you're not just going to buy Bitcoin today and it's going to go to the moon. That's not the way this is going to happen. There's going to be tremendous volatility,
yep.
and the banks and the legacy system is not going to go down without a fight.
Yep.
So we're in this battle now, and there's a lot of naivete. I was at the Bitcoin conference in 2022 in Miami, and I told people then, I said, listen, if you think the banks are just going to take a bow and exit the stage, that's not the way this is going to go. No. There is going to be a financial crisis. There is going to be a cataclysm financially that's going to wash out a lot of them. But at the end of the day, to push Bitcoin over the top, we're going to need a political movement that makes it so.
Yeah, well put, and I fully agree. And I do think that that's one of the arguments I have with, well, debate, let's call it, rather than an argument with individuals about what that are really like into the crypto thing. Yeah, that's actually oftentimes one of the subjects that I debate with individuals that are really into it, because they're like, they're all in, they're not really considering any other geopolitical situations or this and that. But through history, we can yes. learn quite a bit, like early before the Great Depression. If you look at the 1929 stock market, there was many times where they spiked the market, dropped the market, devalued everything, bought everything back on the bottom, and then shot it back up, and so on and so forth. And we all know how that yes. story went. But there's yes. a key moment where they tried to lock people out. And that happened many times in the stock market. My personal yes. fear that comes to back to surveillance as well as censorship is I noticed that when I started dealing with Web3, I started looking into NFTs and this and that, and I started to realize what Web3 can be. And then kind of taking the idea of Web3, combining it with the digital ID that they want to put into place, both for online as well as our lives and CBDCs and so on and so forth, I saw a little bit of a trap where I could see in the future someone having a crap ton of money in crypto but not being able to access it without a third person provider, like, for example, a MetaMask or whatever, where, like yep. I said, so the issue I'm kind of concerned with is that what happens if some situation occurs where you don't have access to it, which is where something like Monero and Pirate Chain could come into play. Are you afraid of any of this stuff? Is this stuff that you consider, or is it just conspiracy hokum?
No, listen, I think your concerns are well-founded. One thing that I would stress, and I really got into crypto in the summer of 2019. I met an Ethereum engineer in Thailand. I was in Bangkok, Thailand, and I met this guy. He was a very smart guy, but like a lot of, I would say, talented engineers, he tended to be very libertarian. Mm-hmm. And the libertarians have this idea that ultimately society can be solved with a very elegant solution, a solution that's almost engineered.
Yeah.
And that solution will empower individuals, and through incentive structures and so forth, it will perfectly neutralize any dangers. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's just not reality. And the reason is because human beings, or rather economic systems, are human systems. I say this all the time. And I'm not sure that people really understand what the hell I'm talking about. Maybe it's a failure on my part to articulate it properly, but human beings are not amenable to binary code.
Yes.
We are very unpredictable. We're spiritual beings. Mm-hmm. And so as we go, systems will go. And that is to say that regardless of how many built-in safeguards there are in any system, if human beings are using it, it becomes a human system, right? Same thing applies to artificial intelligence, by the way.
Right.
So ultimately, that means that if Bitcoin is going to succeed, it means that we'll need a vanguard. We'll need, again, a movement that's going to structure it in the best way possible, that's going to hedge against a subterfuge or subversion, right, or surveillance. In other words, we're going to have to be the watchdogs of the system. Can we do that? Yeah, I think we can. Absolutely. And I think Bitcoin is uniquely positioned in such a way that lends itself to that. Mm-hmm. But without those watchdogs, without that vanguard, you know, these are the people, the engineers that are maintaining the system, the Bitcoin improvement program, you know, these are various human activities that maintain the system. Without that, it will fall apart, right? Or it will be subverted by some third party. So yeah, those things can happen. And it's incumbent upon us human beings to take action to hedge against that. So, you know, I am optimistic. I think those things are going to happen. I think the Bitcoin community is very robust and strong, but it is still vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And we have to be very upfront about that and recognize that it's not the system, it's human beings that are still at the core.
Yeah, I like how you put that. And to kind of sum it all up, it sounds like a lot of the solutions and ideas that you're putting forth are similar to the ones I like to attest to as well. It's build community, build communication, education, and find ways within our own, by our own means, to create solutions to the problems we see in front of us. And I like your attitude towards it, because you're actually out there trying to actually do this yourself. And I do think it's kind of like a race between us and whoever that they are to take hold of the crypto market and manhood in general. Yes. And kind of build our own little fort, as you already put it. And I think that is kind of what you're doing with your show. You said Ad Octum as well. That's a lot of what you guys are kind of trying to build there, right? Is like
yes. So there is very much a war being fought on multiple fronts, as you well know. And you know, one thing I should say as an aside as well is that there is an assumption, it's pervasive among, you know, the red pilled crowd or the black pilled crowd, you know, the awakened ones, mm-hmm. people that tend to be well informed, mm-hmm. they have very little respect and patience for what they term the normies, right? Their assumption is that the normies are simply, and what do we call them? NPCs, right? They're non-entities. They're not participating.
Yes.
That is an egregious mistake.
Yes. Yes.
And it's an egregious mistake in part because there are unconscious forces that are always operating in the background.
Yes.
You know, there's an excellent book that I highly recommend everybody read. It was written in the 19th century. It's called Crowd or The Crowd.
Yeah,
Gustave Le Bon. And Gustave Le Bon wrote a book that would be completely dismissed today.
Yep.
It would be ignored as unscientific babble.
Yep.
And the reason is because he talks about how mass movements begin. Mm-hmm. And they begin because there are these subterranean forces that you can't see that climax, they trigger,
yep.
they all of a sudden they break to the surface. And the reason for that is because the population is thinking, it is aware, mm-hmm. you know, these ideas are percolating, mm-hmm. but action doesn't come until later. Mm-hmm. You know, I liken it metaphorically to volcanoes. Mm-hmm. And I was in France over the summer, and I mentioned this in a video that I made a few weeks ago, but you know, that one of the folks that I met over there said, France is a volcano. Yeah. It's about to erupt. So is the entire Western world. Yep. Well, if the Black Pillars and some of these other folks that are so critical of average folks, if they're right, well then, you know, forget it. Mm-hmm. Nothing's going to happen. That's it's
right.
over.
That's
you know, you might as well cast your lot with some distant island country. But if I'm right, those unconscious forces are manifest everywhere.
Yes.
They're beginning to make landfall, and they're powerful.
Mm-hmm.
They're rooted in many of these breakthrough ideas that we discuss today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, the point is that they can't be measured.
Mm-hmm. That's
right. You can't metricize them. You can't say, oh, well, this number of people, you know, they're at this level of awareness. We don't really know.
Right.
And what, one of the best books on nationalism is talked about this, Ernest Gellner's Nations and Nationalism. And nationalism is the dog that doesn't bark.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, remember in Sherlock Holmes, many of the clues that he finds that ultimately lead him to solve the mystery are indirect. They're subtle. They don't scream, hey, he did it,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, everybody's running around looking for the smoking gun. There is mm-hmm. no smoking gun. There are unconscious forces
yep.
that are going to manifest, and they're going to do so in unpredictable, sudden manners, and they're going to change everything.
Yes, well put. I love how you summed that up. That's amazing. please tell everyone what you like, where they can find you, and plug anything you got coming up. Yeah, go for it. Whatever you got.
Sure. So I suppose the best way to follow me is on YouTube. You just Google my name, Cameron McGregor. Neo-masculinity is the handle, I guess, what we call it. I don't know. I'm still new to social media, Mano. I'm such a boomer. I was so opposed to social media for so many years. Yeah. People have been just adamant that I'm more public. I will say just for a moment, yeah, that social media itself is very dangerous,
yep,
because you get lost in followers and clicks, mm, and subscribers. You know, you mentioned at the beginning that I think I watched a video of yours recently and you said, everybody wants me to talk about this. And it's very difficult to resist, yeah, moving with the crowd on social media. Yeah. It's very, very hard to do that. But I have done so. And I think I'm going to continue to do so. You know, look, if only 50 people watch a video, fine. You know, to hell with it. I'm going to make the videos that I want to make. But you can find me on YouTube. I am posting a lot on Instagram, although I'm still not clear on what Instagram is. I don't get the platform, but I'm posting videos there too, or small snippets. I still think the best content that I produce is my blog. I think it's the written essays. Eventually, I'm going to move to Substack probably next year. But I highly recommend you subscribe to the blog, because that's where the real meat and potatoes of my perspective, I guess, it's all there. And that is the Men in the City blog.
It's great.
And there's, I think, 32 parts to it at this stage, and more is coming. But reading through that is, I think, essential. It's not easy to read. People don't have time anymore. I understand that. But that's where the real work is done. You know, audio, visual is fine, but I think reading is essential. I really do.
I think you're doing a great job online, because you didn't... I'm also kind of like you as well. Certain things deter me. If it's like a little too flashy, a little too, like, it drives me nuts. But your content it's great. And I think that... if you continue doing interviews like this, and like many of the other few that I've heard of you out there, it'll get people interested to want to go read that, because I know that's how I started with your material. I was like, okay, I'll go.
Yeah, really?
Sorry?
How did you get started? Was it through the blog or was it through the videos?
Your blog had popped up because I started doing some early research on the Red Pill community, but I kind of it was like a whole bunch of information, not just on your blog, a whole bunch of people's things I was going through, but it stuck in, yeah, the title of it stuck in my head. And then, yeah, Jay Dyer had you on in April, I believe. And I'm like, yeah, oh, that's the guy. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to check this out. And then as soon as I did, within 2 seconds, I was like drawn in. The conversation wasn't surface level. You don't offer surface level information. And I think there's a lot of that out there. And that's fine for people that want to start off. But people that want to take this a little bit more seriously, I think you're the perfect guy for it. So I even like how you're approaching your social media. And don't worry, I suck at my social media. I absolutely hate it. Like, I got on YouTube a long time ago and then I kind of left it because I kind of didn't like the type of attention I was getting.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, it's a long story.
It can be very toxic, to be sure. You know, I guess in closing, I would say to anybody listening, look, if you've got an idea,
yeah,
if you are passionate about something, if you really believe something, that's what you should do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rest of it, what everybody is chiming in on or saying, hey, you know, you need to replicate Fresh and Fit or whatever.
Right.
We're all fed that kind of material.
Yep.
What do you believe in? You know, that's where you need to start. What do you believe in? And if you don't have an answer to that, that's what you need to figure out. And you can figure that out in various ways, you know, various jobs. Traveling is essential.
Mm-hmm.
Taking action. But figure out what you believe in first.
That's so true.
Then build your life based on that.
That's so true. And that's kind of what I've been doing lately. Like, I had the channel going. I didn't have a direct focus or passion, which is why I didn't kind of like go in all in. But this year I kind of got it and I was like, okay, I'm starting other stuff. Sorry. I'll just say goodbye here, my friend. And hopefully we'll have you back on soon and we'll go deeper into some other subject matter. And truly was a pleasure, brother. Truly was a pleasure.
Happy to do it anytime.
Bored no more.